play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me.
Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous lives.
Imagine if your parents were self-styled bohemians who dressed in matching leopard skin trousers, were super talented and only hung out with the very rich and the very, very famous. Our guest on Radio Gorgeous had these parents. She is Tracy Tynan, costume designer, and she's here talking about her extraordinary life in her memoir called Wear and Tear. Hi, Tracy. A warm welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Lovely to be here.
So let's start with those wacky parents. Who were they and what did they do?
Well, my father, Kenneth Tynan, was a theatre critic and wrote reviews for The Observer. And he also had a stint in New York at The New Yorker. And then he became the dramaturge for the emerging National Theatre. And at the end of his life, he wrote profiles for The New Yorker. And my mother was Elaine Dundy, originally from America, and she was a novelist. And she wrote a couple of very well-received novels, The Dud Avocado, The Old Man and Me. And then she went on to write biographies, and she wrote a biography of Elvis.
How cool!
Called Elvis and Gladys, about him and his mum. And then Peter Finch, and then she did one, Faraday, Louisiana. Anyway, both writers.
Fantastic. So it was an extraordinary upbringing because, for a start, it's how they lived their life was unusual compared to anybody else. Can you describe the sort of things they'd wear and sort of their lifestyle?
Well, you know, they were both very adventurous, very curious. They were in the heart of the theatrical scene in London in the 50s.
And 60s, which was much more vibrant than now, because it was like a bit like being pop stars, wasn't it? It was the kind of cutting edge place.
Yes, and there was John Osborne, Look Back in Anger, all that. And so they were friends with Laurence Olivier, Maggie Smith, you know, whole theatrical crowd. And then my father was really interested in jazz. So there was, you know,
And that was like liking kind of rock music later. It was like the trendy music, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And so there was, you know, Miles Davis and Johnny Dankworth and Cleo Lane and all those people. And a lot of writers, Cyril Connolly. And so they lived very much in those circles. And I would say the basic thing about my childhood was that my father would go out to review plays and then they would stay out late. So they were on a completely different schedule than I was. They were out all night and I was up all day. So we kind of intersected at sort of brief moments before they went out. And so their lives were led in a very adventurous way.
They liked drinking, didn't they? I mean, people drank a lot then after the war. I mean, it was, and also to be a bohemian, you drank. And I think that's what caused most of the dramas, their personalities together with alcohol, don't you think?
Yes, I think definitely it was infused by alcohol. Everybody drank and they stayed up late and they drank and they went to cafes and bars. And
do you remember I have this terrible thing where you couldn't sleep because the music was so loud. Did you have that?
Not quite. Actually, very cleverly, our flat, my room, was way at the other end. So I was kind of a distance from where all the party was going on. And also, a lot of the partying went on outside our flat. I mean, they would have big parties and stuff. There was just they were just generally people that were very curious to know the latest writers, the latest musicians, you know, Bob Dylan showed up at our house one time, and I think it's when he first came to England, and I remember having a conversation with him. I'd just done a painting which I'd won a small prize for. I was like 10 or 11 years old, and he talked about his painting and how he liked to paint. So it was.
So he was really sweet.
Yes, very sweet.
Yeah, he came down to your level.
Yes, exactly. So there was a very eclectic group, and I think my parents always wanted to know who was the newest writer, artist, you know, whomever. I mean, Pauline Boaty was a pop artist, one of the few female pop artists. She was a great friend of the family. And she actually did a painting called Bum, which was of my stepmother's bum. And it's a great pop art icon painting.
Fabulous, fabulous. So, what's your earliest memory?
Well, it's very hard to say. I think I write in the book about some of my earliest memories. One of them is my mother had this sealskin fur coat. And I remember going to a party and falling asleep on top of this coat that was in the bedroom. And I must have been, I don't know, 5 or 6 at the time. And it had this smell of my mother, the sort of mug reef perfume and the cigarette smoke sort of mingled together. And it sort of struck me that this here was something of my mother's that smelt of her, but that was not her, you know, she wasn't in it at the time. So that's one of the earliest. And then my father also, again, cigarette smoke features. There was always a cloud of smoke coming out of his office where he worked, and he usually worked at night. So when I was going to school in the morning, there'd be this sort of residue of smoke coming from his office. And also, he did like to tell me stories of plays that he'd been to.
For a child to understand.
Right, yeah, sort of bedtime story was the play he went to last night. So that was a nice aspect that I shared with him.
So let's talk about your book. Now, because of your love of clothes, you've divided the book into kind of different chapters. And can you tell people how you did that?
Well, the book, each chapter is an item of clothing and a personal story around that item of clothing. And I came up with the idea, I had been writing some of these stories, but I didn't really know how to bring it all together. And I was in a writing class and they said, give us a one sentence description of what your book is about. And as I thought about it, I thought, well, actually, it's really about clothing. And I came up with the idea of doing each chapter of different item of clothing. Well, having decided that, I had then actually put myself in a bit of a cage.
You have to go back.
Yeah. And I had to kind of readjust everything to make that work. And I did, I'm afraid, include a couple of times jewelry to stretch it a bit. But because ultimately I became a costume designer for film and TV, it actually worked out pretty well, I hope. And it was a good way for me to bring all these different stories together.
So you're brought up in England in the 60s in Mayfair. Can you tell us what England was like then?
Well, one thing I do remember was the fogs, the pea soupers, you know, and I really remember as, you know, I guess I must have been 6, 7, 8, going out and it just being dark, you know, and coming back. And there was all this literally kind of soot all over your body. I mean, your nose, you blew your nose and it was sort of black. And so that was quite, I mean, you know, it didn't happen a lot, but it was quite memorable when it happened. London at that time, you know, everything where we lived anywhere in Mayfair, sort of everything closed down at the weekends. It was like completely empty and it was kind of strange and desolate. The other thing I remember, I had different au pairs and one was Norwegian and we went to Norway and they had these incredible things called duvets in Norway and that was so cozy and warm. And in England, we were still lying under piles of blankets. And I remember the moment when duvets came to England and it was like, oh, this is such a miracle, these lovely, light, soft, warm things to lie under at night.
Darling, I only listen to Radio Gorgeous. Aha! Uh-huh. Now let's touch on the au pairs, because obviously your parents were not completely there for you, we've got to be honest. They had their own very strong lives. So what happened if you got attached to an au pair and it changed? Was that a traumatic experience for you?
It was difficult because au pairs traditionally don't really stay much longer than a year or 2 years. So there was, I would get very attached to an au pair and then they would leave. And that was very confusing for me. And then there would be a new au pair and I would have to adjust to that new au pair. And I did become very attached to them to the point she was Italian, I went to Venice. Another was German, I went to Stuttgart.
They must have liked you because... I don't know whether my au pairs liked us because there were three girls and were very naughty, but you, I suppose, were one. And you probably did develop a strong relationship with them.
Yes, I did. Sometimes it was maternal and sometimes it was more, right. I felt like a sister, you know, as I grew older. So I was very attached to them.
So you did need a relationship then outside your parents?
Yes. Yeah. And my parents, they did the best they could, but they both came from quite unusual backgrounds. My father was illegitimate. He only discovered he was illegitimate when he was in his early 20s. His father was a Mr. Peacock, who was the mayor of a small town outside of Birmingham. And he lived with his mum, Miss Tynan, in Birmingham. And so the father would spend the week with his other family and then come back on the weekends to be with Miss Tynan. So it was, definitely...
So he knew his surname was Tynan, didn't he?
Yes.
So he must have thought something was up, and why do you only see this man at weekends?
I really am not sure that he did know something was up until quite late. His mother was very devoted to him and I think tried the best she could to sort of cover up this strange...
So was he an only child?
Yeah, he was an only child.
It does make sense, doesn't it? Because, the sense of entitlement and the kind of, slight... I'm not saying he's a spoilt personality, but you know what I mean? Kind of demanding and... wants his own way.
Yeah, used to getting his own way. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. And my mother grew up with two other sisters. And
what number was she?
She was the middle one.
Oh.
Classic, right?
Same as me.
So, in that, and they came, she came from a wealthy Jewish family in New York, but her father was a difficult bit of a rageaholic. Didn't want daughters, wanted sons. And so he wasn't too happy with the situation. She had a very difficult relationship with him. And her mother, Florence, who I liked a lot, but I think she was a bit passive. And I think my mother felt she didn't stand up enough for her. So I don't think neither of my parents had ideal upbringings. And my mother was also brought up by quite sort of strict German governesses. Mm. So I don't think either of them really knew how to be a parent. And, so they struggled with that. Plus they had these lives that, for their work, demanded they be out all the time. So there was this sort of distance between me and them.
How did they meet then?
They met, actually, my mother was in Paris and she was doing some acting there, actually. She was an actress. And she was coming to London and she wanted to meet Peter Ustinov. That's who she really wanted to meet. Mm-hmm. And somehow this friend said, oh, well, I can't quite arrange that. Why don't you meet Ken Tynan? And they met and they hit it off. And very soon after, they got married. It was a bit of a whirlwind.
So my favourite chapter in the book is called Lemon Yellow Underpants. It's just the best name. Can you tell us about that little story?
Well, it was... the lemon yellow underpants were actually these rather peculiar frilly underpants that my mother had given me for a birthday present. And they'd gone to Spain, which they often did. My father was a big bullfighter aficionado. And she brought back these underpants as a birthday present, which I thought were kind of slightly odd. I wanted a stuffed animal or a doll, but anyway, and I hadn't really wore them. But anyway, I went to the circus with some friends, and afterwards they dropped me off at the flat. And for some reason, I don't know why, I think maybe inspired by what I'd seen at the circus, I decided to moon them. I was like 6 years old as they were driving away. And my father happened to come down to, you know, open the door to me and saw this and said, "What is going on here?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't know, you know." Anyway, so he, I think, decided that maybe this was the moment to tell me the facts of life. And I wasn't really having any of that. And so I just kind of avoided that. And I kind of, I think it was my first experience how an item of clothing could in some way sort of contaminate you. And so I ended up actually flushing one of the lemon yellow underpants down the toilet to get rid of it. And the other thing that I have to mention is that in our living room, on the living room wall, was this huge blow-up of Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights. And I don't know if anybody's familiar with that, but it's a very sort of strange, weird painting with people coming out of each other, and it's kind of quite scary. And while my father was attempting to tell me the facts of life, I'm looking at this painting and just feeling like, oh my God, yes. So anyway, that
I think you were too young.
Yes, yeah.
Really.
But again, the best intentions, you know, I mean.
So, sadly, your parents split up, didn't they, when you were 13?
Yes.
Were you at boarding school by then?
I was at boarding school. I went to a place called Dartington Hall when I was 11 years old.
They would send you there. It's co-ed, free, artistic, amazing place.
Progressive place. Yeah. And that actually was a lifesaver for me to be in a place like that and in the countryside. When I was 13... the house mother called me, it was at night, and said, "Oh, there's a phone call from your mother." And I went, and it turned out that my mother was in, I think they got divorced in Mexico. And letting me know that they were getting divorced. And I wasn't exactly surprised because their rows had been terrific. In fact, they had been fighting on and off for many, many years. And in fact, they'd gone to so many lawyers saying they wanted to get divorced and they're not getting divorced that no lawyer in London would take their case anymore. Like, no, we know you're not going to get divorced. We're not going to go through this. So in a sense, I was relieved that it was finally over because they were just making each other miserable.
So tell us about going to English boarding school, and it's obviously not a normal boarding school.
Well, Dartington was a great spot. I mean, it was in a beautiful part of Devonshire, and it was co-ed and progressive, and there weren't dormitories. We each had our own room, which is incredible luxury at a boarding school. And in fact, when I first got there, you know, the other kids I was with were homesick. And I sort of thought, I felt, well, I should be. I must try and cry, you know. But actually, I wasn't. I was just happy to be away from the drama at home. And there I was able to do, I mean, as well as academic stuff, but there was pottery, there was woodwork, there was all sorts of fun arts and crafts, which I enjoy doing. And in this really beautiful spot in Devon. So it was very
wonderful. So wonderful.
Radio Gorgeous, Gorgeous Lives.
So you say some good stories in the book, and it's kind of the start, and this is kind of the 70s. Is it the 70s by that? It's the kind of start of your love of clothes, kind of happens when you're a teenager, I'd say.
Yeah. It's the late 60s. And one of the things was that a lot of my clothing thing stems from being obsessed with boys too. But anyway, we had this dance at school, and this guy that I had been obsessed with, Duncan, invited me to be his date for the evening. And so I felt I had to have the perfect frock. And so I decided, I'd seen it someplace, a sort of 20s frock with gold shimmy stuff on it, fringe on it. And so I decided I would try and make this frock. And I sort of did, but at a certain point, my sewing skills just weren't up to it. So I took what I had to the local seamstress in Totnes, and she very kindly sort of fixed it up for me. And so I had this wonderful frock with fringe, gold fringe, and Duncan took me to the dance and we danced away. And then a little fatal mistake of going back to my room and drinking too much whiskey, which ended up in being sick and a kind of lifetime aversion to whiskey, I have to say. But anyway, that was the beginning of like making a frock for an occasion. And
getting a thrill from it and realising you could do it.
Yeah, fantastic.
So you left UK and you went to LA. Why did you go to LA?
Well, I didn't directly go to LA. What happened was I was at Sussex University and I was doing social anthropology, and I kind of realised that actually that isn't what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew that it was probably more arts oriented. And at that time, for me to have gone back and changed my major, I would have sort of had to go back to the beginning. So I decided that I would leave Sussex, and I thought, well, I'd always actually enjoyed doing pottery. So maybe that's what I would do. So there was an art school in Maine in America that you could take this summer course at. And so I enrolled in that. And while I was doing that, I realized, actually, I don't want to do pottery for the rest of my life. That's not going to really work out. And I started to do some photography there. And then I thought, you know what, I need to go back to school and figure it out. So there was this college, Sarah Lawrence College, and I applied to that and they accepted me. So my mother's American. I'd always had an American passport, so that actually made it easy for me.
Yeah, compared to other people.
Yeah, and compared to everything today.
Yeah.
So I was able to go to Sarah Lawrence and get a liberal arts degree, perfect theatre, English, art, you know, and I graduated from there.
So do you feel at home, more at home in the States, or did you when you arrived, or were you an English person arriving? Who were you?
I think I always felt a little bit not quite English, not a little outsider-ish. And I think one of the things that always bothered me in England was the minute you opened your mouth, people knew who you were from, what class you were from, and it was kind of this label.
Yeah. And, actually.
Yeah, and I think always will be. And there was something a little more universal in America, and you weren't so quickly labeled. And I like that, the sort of sense of freedom. And I mean, there is stuff in America.
Yeah,
it's geographical,
sure.
Actually. It's, you're from the South, you're from the North.
Yeah.
So, of course, you know, every country has its thing.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy, and now I've lived in America for over 40 years. So, you know, in many ways, I am American. But I have to say, it's lovely to come back to London. There's a familiarity, a scale here that's very wonderful.
I think you're really lucky to have, you know, lived both lives, really. Yeah, yeah, it's fascinating. So your dad remarried. Did you get on with his stepmother?
Well, it was difficult. It was difficult because there was a period before he remarried where I think as a sort of young teenager, I thought, I would have my father all to myself.
Got daddy back.
Yes. You know? And because I'd always been sort of closer to my father. And then there was this sort of shock that, no, it was another woman and she was moving in. So that was a little bit difficult. And I think combined with me becoming a full-on teenager, you know, I mean, poor woman. Yeah, she inherited a sort of rather unruly teenager. So it was not an easy transition. And I think I felt sort of left out, as it were. But also because I was at boarding school, I was away a lot. So it was hard for her to really establish a relationship with me. And then fairly soon after, when I was 16, they had two children. And so I felt even more kind of removed from the whole situation.
You know, it's very difficult, second marriages, because However, even if they're good at doing it, then they weren't, because no one knew how to, you know, act. You still, there's that slight feeling of second-class citizen, isn't there? It's like you're not, because they've created a home and whatever.
Yeah.
Are you really invited to it?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, the good part of it was that experiencing a not-so-good stepmother situation, when I became a stepmother when I was 25, I met the person that's now my husband, and he had a son that was 5 or 6 years old. I understood some of the issues going into that. We didn't actually marry until I was 30, but I was still around a lot. And, you know, I think I had a better sense of how to behave with my stepson. And also my husband made it very clear that Jesse, his son, came first.
Wow, that's great.
And so Jesse, I don't think, had that sense of being ousted. You know?
Fabulous. So that worked well.
No, we're very close. So.
Oh, that's so wonderful. That's so wonderful. Because you did go on. So when I wasn't going to go into much detail about your husband, but is he still in the film biz then?
He teaches film. That's what he does. He taught for 11 years at the American Film Institute, and now he teaches at the Art Center.
Fantastic, you didn't know you were going to end up being a costume designer. It sort of happened by kind of prognosis, kind of by accident, didn't it? Can you tell us about that?
Well, what happened was that very soon after we got married, my husband started to direct a film called Breathless, a remake of the Jean-Luc Godard Breathless. And it happened quite fast. And so he hired production designer, cameraman, costume designer. And the costume designer was a very lovely man called Alan Heifel. But my husband was having difficulty communicating with him. And he would come home at night and he would sort of complain a bit. And I would sort of say, well, maybe this, maybe that. And then finally said, well, look, I'm just going to put you on as an assistant to Alan, and maybe you can help out. And really luckily for me, Alan was a very secure person and wasn't threatened by this. In fact, I think he welcomed it because he was a little confused about what was going on. And so it was a great education for me. And so together we did Breathless, and that was the start of my costume career.
And it was an amazing career. I mean, that's one of my favourite parts of books. You know, it's really colourful. Also, I like the way your style is kind of thrift shop style, which I'll explain to English people. It used to be called secondhand shops. Now it's called vintage. But also it was sort of very in then, the sort of 40s, 50s look. And it was quite easy to, it was easy to source those clothes. Now it's very hard to find them. They're kind of been worn out. But it kind of, you used your taste, do you know what I mean, to kind of create what you created. Do you see what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, also, I think it's hard for people to understand that with film, it starts with the script, reading the script, and figuring out who these characters are. How much money do they earn? What kind of lifestyle do they live? You know, are they people, you know, some people just wear uniforms. They wear the same clothes pretty much all the time. Other people change 3 times a day, you know. You know, there's an arc in a film. Sometimes somebody starts out a rather sort of dowdy person and then emerges into a flower, you know. So there are various things that go on that as a costume designer you have to think about. And particularly when you're working with contemporary film, you don't want it to be completely out of fashion by the next year. So all these things are consideration. Not everybody has good taste, and not everybody should have good taste in a film. I mean, if the character requires it. And sometimes, you know, you see people on the street and you think, oh my God, how did they wake up this morning and think that was all right? And sometimes you see people and you think, wow, what a weird combination, but it kind of works. So it's using all those elements and creating, you know, an interesting. And then you're also working with a production designer who may have a color palette. And one of the things I talk about is, you know, in the film is if your character is sitting on a green sofa and you're wearing a green, the character's wearing a green dress, that's not a good thing, you know. So there are many things that you, and if something is being shot at night, will the character blend into the background or do they have to be in something that stands out?
And also, I found it interesting, but you said that for the lead character, if they wear the clothes quite a lot in the film, you have to have about two or three or even four or five versions of the same thing.
Yeah, no, often actually more, maybe six or so. Gosh. And that, so then those things you probably are more likely to, you know, have made because you want them all to be the same. And then also the stunt people, you know, if they're stunts, they have to be in the same clothing. And often the stunt people are not exactly the same size as your actors. So there's many variables that you're dealing with. And then the other thing is if you have a group of people in a scene, you want to make sure not everybody's dressed in blue or not everybody's wearing exactly the same kind of clothing, you know. Yeah. So it's a challenge.
Yes, someone told me that contemporary is the hardest thing, they said.
And I think that's true because everybody brings to contemporary their own sense of clothing. And not all actors have the greatest taste.
No, I've always noticed that. I've really noticed that. When you see them off duty, you think, I've often thought, what are you wearing?
Yeah.
So weird. Because they're so well styled in the theatre. I don't get that.
Well, it's just one of those things. And so sometimes those actors that you see that aren't so well dressed, they bring that to the character and they get can be very sort of like, but I always wear this kind of clothing. And you have to sort of gently steer them in another direction to something you think's more appropriate.
We've not really touched on your love life or your dad's extraordinary funeral. There's so much in this fabulous book. So if you love clothes, Hollywood, and or if you're interested in the bohemian life and style, then this book is for you. It's Wear and Tear by Tracy Tynan, and it's published by Duckworth. But lastly, I just want to ask, do you wear leopard skin? Because on the cover, it's leopard skin everywhere. And the hilarious thing was, tell us what you're wearing.
Well, I am wearing a leopard skin cardigan, black jeans, and I'm afraid leopard boots. But I have to mention something. Well, I just discovered that, in fact, what my parents are wearing on the cover is not leopard, but ocelot.
I don't believe it. Even more obscure.
Yeah, right.
Thank you so much for coming on. And next time I see you, Tracy, I want you to be head to toe in ocelot.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2017. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. And let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship.
and adore. In other words, please be true.